Chapter 13. Chalk, nor to any of its special uses or abuses, such as milk, neck powder, and the like, but to servants. Surely ours might remove that unseemly little mark. Suppose it were on my coat, might I not request its removal? I remember, when I was at school, a little careless boy, upon whose forehead an ink mark remained, and was perfectly recognizable for 3 weeks after its first appearance. May I take any notice of this chalk stain on the forehead of my house? Whose business is it to wash that forehead, and ought I to fetch a brush and a little hot water, and wash it off myself? Yes. But that spot removed, why not come down at 6, and wash the doorsteps? I dare say the early rising and exercise would do me a great deal of good. The housemaid, in that case, might lie in bed a little later, and have her tea and the morning paper brought to her in bed. Then, of course, Thomas would expect to be helped about the boots and knives, cook about the saucepans, dishes, and whatnot. The lady's maid would want somebody to take the curl papers out of her hair, and get her bath ready. You should have a set of servants for the servants, and these under-servants should have slaves to wait on them. The king commands the first lord-in-waiting to desire the second lord to intimate to the gentleman usher to request the page of the antechamber to entreat the groom of the stairs, to implore John to ask the captain of the buttons, to desire the maid of the still room to beg the housekeeper to give out a few more lumps of sugar, as his majesty has none for his coffee, which probably is getting cold during the negotiation. In our little Brentfords we are all kings, more or less. There are orders, gradations, hierarchies, everywhere. In your house and mine there are mysteries unknown to us. I am not going into the horrid old question of followers. I don't mean cousins from the country, love-stricken policemen, or gentlemen in mufti from Knightsbridge Barracks, but people who have an occult right on the premises, the uncovenanted servants of the house, gray women who are seen at evening with baskets flitting about area railings, dingy shawls which drop you furtive curtsies in your neighborhood, demure little jacks who start up from behind boxes in the pantry. Those outsiders wear Thomas's crest and livery, and call him Those silent women address the female servants as, and curtsy before them, squaring their arms over their wretched lean aprons. Then, again, those servum have dependents in the vast, silent, poverty-stricken world outside your comfortable kitchen fire, in the world of darkness, and hunger, and miserable cold, and dank, flagged cellars, and huddled straw, and rags, in which pale children are swarming. It may be your beer which runs with great volubility, has a pipe or two which communicates with those dark caverns, where hopeless anguish pours the groan, and would scarce see light, but for a scrap or two of candle which has been whipped away from your worship's kitchen. Not many years ago, I don't know whether before or since that white mark was drawn on the door, a lady occupied the confidential place of housemaid in this private residence, who brought a good character, who seemed to have a cheerful temper, whom I used to hear clattering and bumping overhead, or on the stairs long before daylight there, I say, was poor Camilla, scouring the plain, trundling, and brushing, and clattering with her pans and brooms, and humming at her work. Well, as he had established a smuggling communication of beer over the area frontier, this neat-handed Phyllis used to pack up the nicest baskets of my provender, and convey them to somebody outside, I believe, on my conscience, to some poor friend in distress. Camilla was consigned to her doom. She was sent back to her friends in the country, and when she was gone we heard of many of her faults. She expressed herself, when displeased, in language that I shall not repeat. As for the beer and meat, there was no mistake about them. But appers? Can I have the heart to be very angry with that poor jade for helping another poor jade out of my larder? On your honor and conscience, when you were a boy, and the apples looked temptingly over Farmer Quarrington's hedge, did you never? When there was a grand dinner at home, and you were sliding, with Master Bacon, up and down the stairs, and the dishes came out, did you ever do such a thing as just to? Well, in many and many a respect servants are like children. They are under domination. They are subject to reproof, to ill temper, to petty exactions and stupid tyrannies not seldom. They scheme, conspire, fawn, and are hypocrites. Little boys should not loll on chairs. Little girls should be seen, and not heard, and so forth. Have we not almost all learnt these expressions of old foozles, and uttered them ourselves, when in the square toot state? The Eton master, who was breaking a lance with our paterfamilias of late, turned on paterfamilias, saying, he knows not the nature and exquisite candor of well-bred English boys. Exquisite fiddlesticks and, Mr. Master, do you mean for, to go for to tell us, that the relations between young gentlemen, and their schoolmasters are entirely frank and cordial, that the lad is familiar with the man who can have him flogged, never shirks his exercise, never gets other boys to do his verses, never does other boys' verses, never breaks bounds, never tells fibs, I mean the fibs permitted by scholastic honor? Did I know of a boy who pretended to such a character, I would forbid my scapegraces to keep company with him. Did I know a schoolmaster who pretended to believe in the existence of many hundred such boys in one school at one time, I would set that man down as a baby in knowledge of the world. Who was making that noise? Don't know, sir. And he knows it was the boy next him in school. Who was climbing over that wall? Don't know, sir. And it is in the speaker's own trousers. Very likely, the glass bottle tops have left their cruel scars. And so with servants. Who ate up the three pigeons which went down in the pigeon pie at breakfast this morning? Dear me. Sir, it was John, who went away last month. Or, I think it was Miss Mary's canary bird, which got out of the cage, and is so fond of pigeons, it never can have enough of them. Yes, it was the canary bird, and Eliza saw it, and Eliza is ready to vow she did. These statements are not true, but please don't call them lies. This is not lying, this is voting with your party. You must back your own side. The servants' hall stands by the servants' hall against the dining room. The schoolboys don't tell tales of each other. They agree not to choose to know who has made the noise, who has broken the window, who has eaten up the pigeons, who has picked all the plover's eggs out of the aspic, how it is that liqueur brandy of Gladstone's is in such porous glass bottles and so forth. Suppose Brutus had a footman, who came and told him that the butler drank the curacoa, which of these servants would you dismiss? The butler, perhaps, but the footman certainly. No. If your plate and glass are beautifully bright, your bell quickly answered, and Thomas ready, neat, and good-humored, you are not to expect absolute truth from him. The very obsequiousness and perfection of his service prevents truth. He may be ever so unwell in mind or body, and he must go through his service and the shining plate, replenish the spotless glass, lay the glittering fork, never laugh, when you yourself or your guest's joke be profoundly attentive, and yet look utterly impassive, exchange a few hurried curses at the door with that unseen slavey who ministers without, and with you be perfectly calm and polite. If you are ill, he will come 20 times in an hour to your bell, or leave the girl of his heart, his mother, who is going to America, his dearest friend, who has come to say farewell, his lunch, and his glass of beer just freshly poured out, and you're all of these, if the doorbell rings, or the master calls out, Thomas from the hall. Do you suppose you can expect absolute candor from a man whom you may order to powder his hair? As between the Rev. Henry Holishade and his pupil, the idea of entire unreserve is utter bosh. So the truth, as between you, and James or Thomas, or Mary the housemaid, or Betty the cook, is relative, and not to be demanded on one side or the other. Why, respectful civility is itself a lie, which poor James often has to utter, or perform to many a swaggering vulgarian, who should black James' boots, did James wear them and not shoes? There is your little Tom, just 10, ordering the great, large, quiet, orderly young man about shrieking calls for hot water bullying James, because the boots are not varnished enough, or ordering him to go to the stables, and ask Jenkins why the deuce Tompkins hasn't brought his pony round, or what he will. There is Mama rapping the knuckles of Pincott the lady's maid, and little Miss scolding Martha, who waits up 5 pair of stairs in the nursery. Little Miss, Tommy, Papa, Mama, you all expect from Martha, from Pincott, from Jenkins, from James, obsequious civility and willing service. My dear, good people, you can't have truth too. Suppose you ask for your newspaper, and James says, I'm reading it, and just beg not to be disturbed. Or suppose you ask for a can of water, and he remarks, you great, big, hulking feller, ain't you big enough to bring it up yourself? What would your feelings be? Now, if you made similar proposals or requests to Mr. Jones next door, this is the kind of answer Jones would give you. You get truth habitually from equals only. So my good Mr. Holishade, don't talk to me about the habitual candor of the young Etonian of high birth, or I have my own opinion of your candor or discernment when you do. No. Tom Bowling is the soul of honor, and has been true to black-eyed Siason since the last time they parted at Wapping Old Stairs. But do you suppose Tom is perfectly frank, familiar, and above board in his conversation with Admiral Nelson, K.C.C.? B. There are secrets, prevarications, fibs, if you will, between Tom and the Admiral, between your crew and their captain. I know I hire a worthy, clean, agreeable, and conscientious male or female hypocrite, at so many guineas a year, to do so and so for me. Were he other than hypocrite, I would send him about his business. Don't let my displeasure be too fierce with him for a fib, or two on his own account. Some dozen years ago, my family being absent in a distant part of the country, and my business detaining me in London, I remained in my own house with 3 servants on board wages. I used only 2 breakfast at home, and future ages will be interested to know that this meal used to consist, at that period, of tea, a penny roll, a pat of butter, and, perhaps, an egg. My weekly bill used invariably to be about 50 shillings, so that, as I never dined in the house, you see, my breakfast, consisting of the delicacies before mentioned, cost about 7 shillings and 3 pence per diem. I must, therefore, have consumed daily, a quarter of a pound of tea, say, 1/3 a penny roll, say, 1/0 1 pound of butter, say, 1/3 1 pound of lump sugar, 1/0 a new laid egg, 2/9, which is the only possible way I have for making out the sum. Well, I fell ill while under this regimen, and had an illness which, but for a certain doctor, who was brought to me by a certain kind friend I had in those days, would, I think, have prevented the possibility of my telling this interesting anecdote now a dozen years after. Don't be frightened, my dear madam. It is not a horrid sentimental account of a malady you are coming to, only a question of grocery. This illness, I say, lasted some 17 days, during which the servants were admirably attentive and kind, and poor John, especially, was up at all hours, watching night after night, amiable, cheerful, untiring, respectful, the very best of John's and nurses. Twice or thrice in the 17 days I may have had a glass of eau sucré, say a dozen glasses of eau sucré, certainly not more. Well, this admirable, watchful, cheerful, tender, affectionate John brought me in a little bill for 17 pounds of sugar consumed during the illness, then add sugar and water. Always was a calling for it, says John, wagging his head quite gravely. You are dead, years and years ago. Poor John, so patient, so friendly, so kind, so cheerful to the invalid in the fever. But confess, now, wherever you are, that 17 pounds of sugar, to make 6 glasses of eau sucré, was a little too strong, wasn't it, John? Ah, how frankly, how trustily, how bravely he lied, poor John! One evening, being at Brighton, in the convalescence, I remember John's step was unsteady, his voice thick, his laugh queer, and having some quinine to give me, John brought the glass to me not to my mouth, but struck me with it pretty smartly in the eye, which was not the way in which Dr. Elliotson had intended his prescription should be taken. Turning that eye upon him, I ventured to hint that my attendant had been drinking. Drinking. I never was more humiliated at the thought of my own injustice than at John's reply. Drinking. Soap me. I have had only one pint of beer with my dinner at 1 o'clock. And he retreats, holding on by a chair. These are fibs, you see, appertaining to the situation. John is drunk. Opem, he has only had an elf pint of beer with his dinner 6 hours ago, and none of his fellow servants will say otherwise. Polly is smuggled on board ship. Who tells the lieutenant when he comes his rounds? Boys are playing cards in the bedroom. The outlying fag announces master coming out. Go candles, cards popped in two bed boys sound asleep. Who had that light in the dormitory? Law bless you, the poor dear innocents are everyone snoring. Everyone snoring, and every snore is a lie told through the nose. Suppose one of your boys or mine is engaged in that awful crime, are we going to break our hearts about it? Come, come. We pull a long face, waggle a grave head, and chuckle within our waistcoats. Between me and those fellow creatures of mine who are sitting in the room below, how strange and wonderful is the partition. We meet at every hour of the daylight, and are indebted to each other for 100 offices of duty and comfort of life, and we live together for years, and don't know each other. John's voice to me is quite different from John's voice when it addresses his mates below. If I met Hannah in the street with a bonnet on, I doubt whether I should know her. And all these good people with whom I may live for years and years, have cares, interests, dear friends and relatives, may have schemes, passions, longing hopes, tragedies of their own, from which a carpet and a few planks and beams utterly separate me. When we were at the seaside, and poor Ellen used to look so pale, and run after the postman's bell, and seize a letter in a great scrawling hand, and read it, and cry in a corner, how should we know that the poor little thing's heart was breaking? She fetched the water, and she smoothed the ribbons, and she laid out the dresses, and brought the early cup of tea in the morning, just as if she had had no cares to keep her awake. Henry, who lived out of the house, was the servant of a friend of mine who lived in chambers. There was a dinner one day, and Harry waited all through the dinner. The champagne was properly iced, the dinner was excellently served, every guest was attended to, the dinner disappeared. The dessert was set, the claret was in perfect order, carefully decanted, and more ready. And then Henry said, "If you please, sir, may I go home?" He had received word that his house was on fire, and, having seen through his dinner, he wished to go and look after his children and little sticks of furniture. Why, such a man's livery is a uniform of honor. The crest on his button is a badge of bravery. Do you see, I imagine I do myself in these little instances, a tinge of humor? Ellen's heart is breaking for handsome James of Buckley Square, whose great legs are kneeling, and who has given the lock of his precious powdered head to some other than Ellen. Henry is preparing the sauce for his master's wild ducks, while the engines are squirting over his own little nest and brood. Lift these figures up, but a story from the basement to the ground floor, and the fun is gone. We may be in plain tragedy. Ellen may breathe her last sigh in blank verse, calling down blessings upon James the profligate who deserts her. Henry is a hero, and epaulets are on his shoulders. At who I see but, and see, whatever tortures are in store for him, he will be at his post of duty. You concede, however, that there is a touch of humor in the two tragedies here mentioned. Why? Is it that the idea of persons at service is somehow ludicrous? Perhaps it is made more so in this country by the splendid appearance of the liveried domestics of great people. When you think that we dress in black ourselves, and put our fellow creatures in green, pink, or canary-colored breeches, that we order them to plaster their hair with flour, having brushed that nonsense out of our own heads 50 years ago, that some of the most genteel and stately among us cause the men who drive their carriages to put on little albino wigs, and sit behind great nosegays. I suppose it is this heaping of gold lace, gaudy colors, blooming plushes, an honest John Trot, which makes the man absurd in our eyes, who need be nothing but a simple reputable citizen and indoor laborer. Suppose, my dear sir, that you yourself were suddenly desired to put on a full dress, or even undress, domestic uniform with our friend Jones' crest repeated in varied combinations of button on your front and back. Suppose, madam, your son were told that he could not get out except in lower garments of carnation or amber-colored plush, would you let him? But as you justly say, this is not the question, and besides it is a question fraught with danger, sir, and radicalism, sir, and subversion of the very foundations of the social fabric, sir. Well, John, we won't enter on your great domestic question. Don't let us disport with Jim's dangerous strength, and the edge tools about his knife board, but with Betty and Susan who wield the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.